So here we are on a full moon night. Can't actually see the moon, but it's sort of hovering there, sort of behind the clouds. Sometimes it's like that. And I am Amra Chandra, just in case you didn't get that. So I am, and my name means a deathless moon or eternal moon. And I want to dedicate this talk to a friend of mine, Amara Shraddhar, another Amara sister, who was a Dutch order member, and she died earlier this year. So I want to dedicate this to her because she has that undying quality as well, that eternal quality, and her quality is faith. So I felt very connected to her through our shared name. So I want to dedicate this to my friend Amara Shraddhar. And when we come to do the puja, I think we can bring Anjali a lot more to mind, and we can sort of think about Anjali within the puja. So great. So thank you to the shrine makers, Ayajaya, Ratnagosha, who made the shrine, this lovely sort of gold and silver shrine, and to Padmajata, who's lent this tanka. I love this tanka, it's so beautiful. And it's quite unusual, the silveriness. If you get a chance at the end, have a look a bit closer up. So this is White Tara. There she is. We'll be talking about her a bit. So I want to start, I want to start with a little moon story. So about 2 years ago, I was visiting some friends in northern New South Wales, and they live in a property, on a property that's in the bush. So it's in the bush, and it's very remote, and it's kind of in a national park. So it's dark, and in Australia it's just so remote that once you get out of the cities, you don't see any street lights, you don't have any light pollution. There's nothing else there. It's just you and nature, you and the night sky, and the night sky often doesn't have any clouds. So it's very open, it's very bright, it's great for stars, and it's great for the moon. So I had a little walk. Some people here have been to Naga Naga. So it's a vihara run by some order member friends, some women who live there. And they have this house on a ridge, and then you sort of walk down and sort of to little caravans and things that are sort of a bit further down the hill. And my caravan where I was staying was about a walk from here to Auckland Road to the community there. And I'd have to do this at night, obviously. And I had a torch, but I was kind of, you know, like there's a bit of a track, but there's also kangaroos, and there are these great big sort of goanna lizards, and the odd snake. I mean, those guys are all probably asleep. What I was most worried about were these enormous spider webs, like enormous spider webs made of this, like this tough stuff. I did not want to run into those. So I had the torch, and as I was sort of going down the ridge, I'm sort of looking out for everything. And then I realized the moon was there. And if I turned the torch off, actually, there was quite a lot of light from the moon. And I was surprised. I didn't realize how bright the moon was. And because, you know, in the city, we like looking at the moon, don't we? We go out, we look at the moon, we go, oh, it's so beautiful, you know, or the moon. But it's just beautiful and nice. It's not necessary. It's not vital. It doesn't sort of really light up in that way. So so when I was in the country, I just got this sense of how important the moon is and how bright it is. I had a shadow. It's like, wow, this is amazing. So it was a kind of ancient experience as well, because I felt like I was really connected back back through the centuries to when people really needed to rely on the light of the moon to do things or to sort of, you know, stretch out the day a bit. So, of course, I thought of White Tara as I was worshipping the moon. And, you know, because she is connected with the moon. She's white. She has these sorts of auras around her. And she's a sort of perfect sort of moon colour. So I felt very sort of happy, very grateful to the moon that it sort of shone my path down to the cabin. And I really understood that, you know, in times gone past, I definitely would have been a moon worshipper. If there was a moon cult, I definitely, definitely would have joined a moon cult. And perhaps I have joined a moon cult. So White Tara is the colour of 100 autumn moons. That's how she's described in the texts. She's radiant, she's beautiful, she has a pearly sort of shimmer. She is the moon goddess. That's great, everyone's sort of looking up. She's the sort of, she is the moon goddess. But I think as well, she also, she seemed to link me very much to my earthly experience as well. So it's not just about the sort of, the celestial sort of cosmic experience. She really sort of links to the earth. You know, she's, the moon is about sort of rhythm. It's about, when you plant crops and when you sort of reap crops. It's got phases. There's a dark moon. It's linked to our menstrual cycles. Sometimes it's close to the earth. Sometimes it's far away. It sort of affects the tides. So it really affects us on the earth. Perhaps us in cities in the 21st century, not as much as in the past. But in the past, it sort of really governed people's lives. So I think there's a sort of, even though the moon is sort of above and beyond this sort of light in the darkness, it's very much about being on earth and linking us to sort of nature and to sort of these natural rhythms. And I had a little taste of the moon again on the yatra. There are two yatra people in the audience, and Eileen is another, she is a moon worshipper of the present day. I think the moon was full on the yatra. If you've never been on the yatra, it was really good. Just throw a little ad in for the yatra. But I think you stayed up, that we had a full moon. It was really beautiful. And Eileen was awake until 3 o'clock in the night. Is that, yeah, I'm watching the moon with a sort of bivy bag open and her tent open, just sort of enjoying the moon, and I was enjoying your enjoyment of the moon. So So as I was sort of walking down to my, it was a long walk, I walked several nights down to my little cabin at Naga Naga, looking up at the moon, I was also thinking of the Buddha, actually, because in the early days of, centuries gone by, not even just the early days, the Buddha encouraged the monks and the nuns to meet on full moon nights. And I started to think, I suppose a lot of the time they were on their own, and they were quietly meditating, doing stuff on their own, relatively solitary, getting on with their practice. So the Buddha encouraged the monks and the nuns to meet together on full moon nights to share their practice, to develop friendships with each other, to sort of talk about the Dharma, be enthusiastic about the Dharma. And a full moon night with all that light is a perfect night to do it, because you can walk to meet your friend across the mango grove without stumbling over any tree roots. You may still meet a tiger, but you know, it's sort of relatively safe, and then you can sort of talk to your friends, and you can see their faces. So I thought about the moon extending the day, really. So the moon extends, the full moon extends the day, because you've got a little bit of extra light to do things with. And I know in the past, you know, sometimes, you know, if it was a full moon night, you could sort of take a carriage ride, or you could make a journey, because the moon would be there as a sort of light. So that was interesting. I hadn't really thought of that before, but the moon extends the day. So it's very auspicious to practice on a full moon night. Maybe that is originally because of the effort it would have been to stay up all night, but it's very auspicious to practice together under the light of the moon. 7 times more merit is what I remember. Might be more, who knows. And the full moon was also used as a symbol in Zen Buddhism a lot. So it's a symbol of the bodhicitta arising, but it's also a symbol of pure and perfect enlightenment, the sort of the full roundness of the moon, the perfect sort of miracle of the full moon. And again, when the sky is really clear, you really see the boundaries really clearly, don't you? It's not sort of misty or fuzzy. The moon is sort of perfectly round. So there's nothing more to be done. The sort of the waxing has happened, and there it is, it's perfect. So it's a sort of symbol of perfect enlightenment. So these were some of my thoughts as I walked down the track to my little cabin. So White Tara is connected with the moon. And so let's talk a little bit about White Tara. So I've already said she is the colour of 100 autumn moons. It's quite a colour, isn't it? It's quite a sort of pearly colour, quite a sort of luminous, radiant colour. It's not too blinding, is it? It's very inviting. It's kind of, I quite like this tanka with this sort of golden quality that it has. It's imbued with a sort of pearly, luminescent, sort of golden sort of colour. I don't think it's a bluey moon colour, because she's got the heart. I think it's more of a goldy, rose sort of creamy colour. And, of course, tonight is autumn, and it's an autumn full moon, so I think it's perfect. I mean, obviously designed by Ratna Ghosha. But it's a perfect night to do a full moon puja to White Tara. So she is this sort of golden, this beautiful white colour. White is purity, white is luminous, white is inviting, and it's the centre of things. When things move towards the centre, they sort of become pure, they become white. And where have I got the story of the birth of Tara? I haven't got... This talk is sort of does this. When I've done it at home, it sort of moves into all these different sort of lengths. But I think... I don't know where I've put it here. Oh, here it is down here, so I'll keep to my notes. Okay, so then... So if you know the form of Green Tara, so Green Tara is the sister of White Tara, and her leg is down. So her leg is down, stepping out into the world. But White Tara's leg, White Tara is in full meditation posture. And I just get you just to sort of imagine what that difference is. So sort of thinking of the leg down, and then what it means to, if you're sort of Green Tara, you're sort of there, what do you need, world? I'm ready to sort of spring into action. What does it mean when she takes her leg up, when she puts her leg into full meditation posture, and she sort of sits herself still, calm. She closes her eyes for meditation. She withdraws within. It's a different feel, isn't it? And I thought I'd just read a little bit that I really love from T.S. Eliot. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshness, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there is the dance. But neither arrest or movement, and do not call it fixity, where past and present are gathered. Neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the still point, there would be no dance. and there is only the dance. So I think it kind of nicely captures that, the sense that in the stillness there's all movement. So it's not stillness that's fixed, it's stillness that's sort of poised, stillness that's alive and ready, and it's like the sort of the booming sound of silence. She's the sort of the radiance of stillness. She's quiet, she's stable, she's internal. Her eyes are closed, and sometimes the eyes are slightly sort of turned inwards, showing that she's sort of turned her attention inwards. So she's quiet, she's calm, she's centered, she's complete, she's whole. And the circle of the full moon is a sort of perfect symbol for that, really, isn't it? So she's quite a mysterious bodhisattva, and sort of in a way, I hope we can get a sense of some of the sort of paradoxes of White Tara. So she is both wisdom and compassion. All bodhisattvas are wisdom and compassion, but she has it sort of more clearly. She embodies both aspects. So she's compassion, and she's part of the lotus family. So Green Tara is part of the action family. She is sort of in Amoghya Siddhi's family, as I say. But White Tara is part of Amitabha's sort of realm. And she often has Amitabha in her hair. And I like the tankers best when she has Amitabha in her hair, because Keshu Raja agrees. it's just like, oh, there's Amitabha, you know, it's like, oh, she rests on Amitabha. She needs to rest on something too, and she rests on the great compassion. So Amitabha is often in her hair. In this one, she's got a sort of, it's like, God, I don't know, it's a sort of shell with jewels or something. Anyhow. I don't know what that is. So she's often got Amitabha in her hair, and Amitabha is infinite light. And so, you know, that sort of works in well, doesn't it, with this sort of sense of the sort of luminous presence of the moon in the night sky. So, in this tanker here, you can see down the bottom is Amitayus. So Amitayus is an aspect of Amitabha, but is more associated with long life. So Amitayus is infinite life, and he holds a nectar, a sort of a jar of Amrita in his lap. So she's often on a White Tara tanker, there is Amitayus, infinite life, and we'll come to that as well. So you end up with both. And of course, she was born from the tears of Avalokiteshvara. So when Avalokiteshvara, sort of at some stage, the great bodhisattva, sort of looked down over the world and sort of was working ceaselessly to sort of end suffering. And then had a moment of just sort of being overwhelmed by the suffering of the world, and tears flowed down his face, and two lakes appeared, two lakes formed of these tears, and in one lake arose the Bodhisattva Green Tara, and in the other lake the Bodhisattva White Tara. So at that stage something happened, and Avalokiteshvara was sort of magically transformed. He sort of broke apart, and he sort of became the sort of super bodhisattva, the transformer bodhisattva, with all these arms and 11 heads. But and Amitabha sort of transformed him and put his head at the top as well. So Amitabha is there with Avalokiteshvara, and Amitabha is in White Tara's hair as well. So keeping that sort of sense of her lineage with the sort of the lotus family, with that great heart of compassion. But she's also wisdom, so she's Sophia as well. And the wisdom is best shown in her very mysterious eyes. So if you look more closely, you'll see that she has her two eyes in the usual position. And then she has an eye of wisdom that's opened here. And in her hands and on the soles of her feet, she has more eyes. So she has seven eyes of wisdom. So these eyes are often associated with the five wisdoms of the jhanas. And actually on this tanka there are the five jinnas above the above her, and that's great as well, because Sangha Knight's been looking at the jinnas, so doesn't that sort of work out really well? Good tanka to have. So this tanka sort of links her with the jinnas, but her wisdom eyes as well link her with the jinnas, link her with that wisdom. So she has all the wisdoms, everything we could sort of want. And then more, because she has the two more eyes that see the world as it is. They sort of look down, they see us. We are in her gaze. It's not just the sort of the great wisdom. She can see us. She can see us just as we are. She can see us with such kindly eyes. And I don't know, sometimes in the puja, when it gets to the sort of section of standing before them with hands raised in reverence and terrified of suffering, and it's too much, it's like, oh, you know, I haven't been that bad. I can think of White Tara, actually. I think of White Tara because it makes that verse much more palatable. I can stand there terrified of suffering if actually it's White Tara who's looking down. If it's White Tara I'm relating to, rather than, I don't know, the pit fire of hell is what I sort of imagine. So she has these very kindly eyes that look at us and see us with compassion. So she has this dual nature of wisdom and compassion, and she embodies both. She is whole. So she is Sophia, she is wisdom. She is the goddess. And because she's the moon as well, she sort of harnesses our unconscious as well. She can tap into the wholeness of us, so we can bring the whole of ourselves to our practice with White Tara. She sees our true nature, which is whole, immutable, eternal, amara, mysterious. So her mudra, she does this. So it gets very open. So she's got sort of legs folded and she does this. So this gesture here is fearlessness. So she holds it to her heart. And then how do you practice fearlessness? Well, actually, if you truly go for refuge to the three jewels, then you can practice fearlessness. So the three fingers are up. So it's fearlessness in the three jewels. And, I mean, many of the bodhisattvas are like this, but it's sort of like, I love the fact that it's that from this fearlessness blooms a sort of the blossom of our true potential. So it's from this gesture that the blossom of our full potential arises. So it's from going for refuge, from holding the three jewels to our heart, that we can really sort of bloom and transform. And the other hand is open and sort of stretches out towards us. How far can she stretch that hand? It's sort of right out there. So she's granting boons, she's giving. And at the moment, it's sort of like my reflection is, well, if I rely on the three jewels, then it sort of things come. I have everything I need. What more do I want the world to give me? It's all there. So White Tara is ready to give, ready, open to sort of meet our needs in any way that we need them met. And actually, what sort of needs do I really have? What are my true needs? I live in a very rich society. I don't really need that much. Actually, what we all sort of really need the most is the Dharma. So it's letting go of ego. It's letting go of a sort of concern with the self. And it's a sort of openness to myself, to practice, and sort of to the bigger picture in a way. So when I first realised I was interested in Tara, getting interested in Tara, it was because of the stillness quality. I was like, give me some stillness. Help me to be more grounded. Let me be a sort of a mountain or rock solid or something like that. And then when I got ordained, I got this name, Amara Chandra, Deathless Moon, and I couldn't, you know, it's like, what does that mean? So I put that aside for a while. I sort of related to it a bit, but I didn't relate to the long life aspect. I suppose that's what I'm coming around to, this long life aspect of White Tara. I didn't really know what that meant. But the more I sort of thought about my name, the more I started to sort of relate to this sort of long life part. How can, you know, the moon has phases. It's not eternal. It's not immutable. How does a deathless state relate to the moon, which is always changing? So Vasantra says very, very well in his chapter on White Tara in his book. He sort of says, well, granting long life, actually, it's not really very long. Even if we have a long life, it's not very long. And, you know, don't really want to live too long, to be honest. You know, I don't want to be sort of 120, you know. No, I won't go into the description of that, but, you know, it's like long life isn't very long. You know, and a useful life isn't very long. So even if White Tara is to sort of increase my life by, it's still not very long. And actually, how much time do I waste in my long, short life? So then I thought, well, how do I think differently about this? How do I think differently about this sort of this amara, this eternal, this immutable sort of with this idea of long life and the moon, and or long life, short life. Sorry, having a short life and the moon. And I started to realize, I mean, I knew this already, but anyhow, it sort of hit me that eternal doesn't mean very, 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 very long. Eternal is something different. What is it? What is it in my life, in my practice? Actually, it's about being present. It's about being present now. So actually, if I am present, then actually I'm living in the moment. And that is a kind of eternal experience, because it's not about the past, it's not about the future, or the other way around. It's about what's happening now. And actually being present in the moment is the best practice, because my life can't be very long, but it can be rich, and it can be meaningful, and it can be alive. And actually, if I'm in the present moment, it can be all those things. I can be more fully myself. I can be more fully present with other people. I can understand my sort of situation much more. And I can be aware of the bigger picture as well. So I've sort of got this sense of eternal, being the eternal present, really, rather than a sort of really long stretch of time. So, yeah, I'm sort of more alive, I'm happier, I'm more engaged, more present, and sort of have this wider experience. And I think it's really important to just think about being happy, you know, cultivating happiness. I'm plagiarising this from a sermon I heard the other day at King's College after a heavy day at work. I was like, oh, I'll go to hear Evensong. And the guy gave a really nice sermon about just being happy. And I was like, that's a really good teaching, isn't it? It's so simple. Just be happy. And I just thought of it in this sort of context. It's like, not about the past, not about the future, not about all my worries. It's about being present now and just valuing life. Not, you know, don't have to stretch it out for a really long time. But if I live a rich and fulfilling life, that is better than just a long life. And so finally, I'd just like to think about I was, along with this sort of reflection, when I heard that Anjali was unwell on Friday, I really brought her to mind. And it was very, she felt very sort of alive and present. And then on the Saturday, again, she felt so alive and present. And I was really able to sort of stay with my thoughts of her. And then I realized, actually, I thought, this isn't my mindfulness. This isn't my awareness. This is her practice. And then I thought, it's not just her practice. It's the practice of everyone who's sort of sitting around her. And it's the practice of the order really holding her in mind. But it did feel like there was a there was an atmosphere, or there was a resonance of something that was helping me to hold in with an awareness of Anjali. I said this to Arya Jaya, and she was like, yeah, I think I know what you mean. I said this to Tejas Vinny, and you said something sort of similar, that there was a very strong, peaceful atmosphere of awareness and of sort of metta at her bedside. And I really, really felt that. So I think as well, when I was thinking about this sort of aspect of White Tara, which is about sort of long life or a good life or a meaningful life, it was I feel really moved and influenced by that, because how do I want to die? How do I want to live? What atmosphere do I want? What friendships do I want? What do I want to cultivate? Who do I want to be? And Anjali really gave herself to the order. She gave herself completely and fully. And the friends around her also did that. They're very strong practitioners, and I really felt their practice. So it sort of brings me just to another sort of moon memory, which is I used to live at Coogee Beach, and I lived in the women's community, and we looked over Coogee Beach, and it was a pretty nice place to live. And I remember one time, I think I was walking back from my GFR group, which consisted of, I think it was just one other friend actually, and who was also at Coogee. So I was walking from to my community from my GFR group, and the moon rose over the sea. I can't tell you how beautiful it was. This great big golden moon just appeared out of the sea, and shimmery moonbeams and moonlight played across the water like a ladder that sort of led to the moon. And it was just like Venus rising from the waters. And this golden moon rose up and rose higher, and this sort of shimmery sort of path sort of played upon the sea. And as I watched it, it really did have this sense of, oh, that's what it means when they sort of talk about the bodhicitta arising. Because I did have this sense of, well, it's not my moon. I am partaking in this sort of beautiful experience of watching the moon rise, but it's not my moon. Anyone who turns towards this moon can also enjoy this beautiful sight. And so all of us together, as we sort of turn towards the moon, as we turn towards our practice, towards White Tara, we can practice together to sort of build this atmosphere, to build this quality of practice, so that eventually we're all there, maybe on this sort of celestial Coogee Beach, watching the moon rise over the water with this beautiful sort of ladder or sort of trail or train of silvery golden light on the water, and the moon sort of breaks free of the sea and sort of rises up into the sky. So that's it.